this country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Daniel Luke Criddle, and welcome to The Crossroads. I'd like to introduce my guest, Neville Archibald from Victoria. How are you doing there, Neville?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Daniel. It's a nice day today, so we'll see what topics we've got to discuss, eh?
Well, there's plenty of topics for us, but there's one particular topic at the very start that would be helpful for us is the audience. We have set up an email address for the audience to send their questions to. Obviously, we do cover a large and broad range of subjects here at the Crossroads. And some of it is quite technical. And even to my, as I'm certainly punching above my pay wage here. But if you do, as an audience member, have a question for us, just at the bottom of the screen now is questions@alor.org. It would be greatly appreciated to hear from the audience, have a bit of audience interaction. Again, if you're struggling with a subject, or perhaps we can point you in the right direction of some more knowledge and information regarding your line of subject of research. So it would be great to hear from you. What do you think, Neville? Do you think we should have some audience participation?
Always, mate. Always. That's how you learn something. If you don't ask a question, you end up being dumb. Sit in the back of the class and say nothing the whole time, and things go over your head, and it eventually compounds, and you don't know where you're ending up, because you haven't taken the time to look into things. I mean, if you look at the links that we're popping up there too, that's always a good start of looking at things. The subjects that we discuss usually pop up in a link as well. So yeah, take full advantage of it, and take full advantage of us sitting here yakking our heads off. Because sometimes we've got important things to say, and sometimes we can probably help you or point you in the right direction of where you would find the information you're looking for. Yeah, definitely a good idea.
Well, one book I want to reference again for some knowledge and information. I know I referenced it last week, but I'll be referencing it again because it's a fantastic book. And that is Stephen A. Zunger's Lost Science of Money. And the one particular part I want to highlight today is right there. Is free, I'm looking at your screen instead of mine. Free bargaining necessary? So the scholastics were highly concerned as to whether the individual was subjected to fraud or duress while they were negotiating contract. A modern similar situation exists, as I understand it today, with the end user license agreement when you utilize a computer. Since the negotiations is completely one-sided, your only opportunity to respond is either clicking next or yes, the validity of the end user license agreement can be thrown into question in my opinion. I don't believe it would be necessarily binding because the conditions necessary for free bargaining simply do not exist. It's a vacuum. You can only click next or yes, and that's an unacceptable situation, which would lead to my next image. I used to work at a workplace. It will remain unnamed, but there is a poster on the wall, and this is the one. Thank you very much. I'll just put it up on my screen so I can read it too. Modern slavery. What you need to know about modern slavery. The workforce that I used to work with is a highly migrant workforce from all parts of the world, and I do mean literally all parts of the world. And they could potentially be subjected to conditions that are not great, but it's not. While this document highlights migrant workers, all citizens of all nations on this entire planet that are subjected to debt are largely a slave. Unfortunately, if you look at the conditions surrounding this that are stated in this document, the one that would be of particular interest in this modern day and age, considering most Australians, as I understand it, are living paycheck to paycheck, week to week, and that paycheck is not going as far as it used to. Even I've experienced this, and when I go to the shops, my wages no longer go as far as they used to. I used to live north here in Western Australia. I used to be able to do a shop up there for $150 a week. Mind you, this was the beginning of the 2000s, so over 20 years ago. But in that time, even though that was a remote rural area, I'm now living in the metro area of Perth, the prices of everything far exceeds what I was paying even just 20 years ago. But experience sleep and food deprivation. We highlighted an article last week from the ABC talking about during COVID, many people received additional money in addition to their pensions. And for a brief moment, they were taken out of poverty. They were able to actually make the decisions between putting extra food on the table and going to the doctor. And that was a largely beneficial thing for everyone. Which leads into the next document from same business. It's the ethical document that's their ethical policy, should I say. It's been adopted to hide the name of the business. But strangely enough, this ethical document does something that the European Union does not, the United Nations does not, and the Islamic regime does not. And it makes mentions of wages. And I'm just trying, let me just, if you'll bear with me one moment. And it says here, it's quite a few points. It's just up from the bottom near the middle, meeting a minimum national legal standards or industry benchmark standards, whichever is higher, in regards to wages and benefits for a standard working week. Written confirmation of their wages shall be provided. Now, this is a private institution, obviously being a largely, broadly speaking, a chicken factory. It is quite curious, as an ethical document, they make mention of wages, whereas if you take the time and effort to get the PDF files yourself, you get the European Charter of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the European Charter of Human Rights, and the Islamic Declaration of Human Rights. You can search all those three documents and you will find zero mentions of money. Absolutely no right to money. You have the right to work, but you have no right to money. And it is a very curious and strange omission, considering many of the rights in these documents are easily obtainable if you had money in your pocket. It's very simple as that. The only discrepancy between the productive system and your ability to consume it is the distributive system, which is money, your wages, salaries, and dividends. And this is where Clifford Douglas comes in with his fantastic thinking of the national dividend, your share of national productivity. Your thoughts, please, Paul.
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept, isn't it? We've got three lots of human rights declarations, you know, from the UN, the EU, and the Islamic regime, and none of them mention money. I'd be interested to go back and look at whether they mention employment or wages or any of the other stuff. I might have to do that. You were talking about...
It does mention a right to work.
Yeah, of course you always got a right to work. Yeah, that's part of slavery, isn't it? Yeah.
Correct.
If we go back to Orwell's doublespeak, yeah. You mentioned the end-use license agreements online and how you've only got the opportunity to click to accept it or not click and don't use it. So there is no bargaining involved in the license agreement. So it's not really an agreement unless it's a one-sided agreement. And I think there's an awful lot of that goes on these days everywhere online. Doesn't matter which institution you're talking to, you're told, you know, whether it's telecom or whether it's, you know, the banks, you go on to do a transfer or to manage someone's affairs if they've, you know, given you power of attorney or something. And suddenly, and I've had to do this just recently, suddenly you're faced with a whole series of pages of things you've got to click and respond to, but there's no way of altering anything. So you have to accept it as it is. You can't say, I'm sorry, I don't agree with that. I'm not going to do that. You know, I don't agree with that concept. I think that's wrong. And there's no way to change it. If you go into the banks themselves, the people behind the screens really don't know how to deal with it either. And again, you can spend a lot of time and effort trying to sort things out and still end up with only their version. So it's always a one-sided agreement. Online now, that when you start looking for jobs, a lot of the times, you know, you've got to submit your resume online. And all the other things are all done online as well. There's very few paper copies of anything anymore. And once again, it depends on how the system is set, but there are things you cannot disagree with or you just don't get employed. So it really is a restrictive practice. There is no bargaining in many cases. I remember back in when I worked at Canberra for a local politician there in the state government that then was, still is. That was back in 91, I think. I did 6 months as an intern for a member, as a what you call a PA, personal assistant. And they came around with a paper copy of an agreement, and there was quite a few pages in it. And I thought, well, you know, I'm serious here. I'm going to have a look through it. So I looked through it, and there's a lot of stuff in there that I didn't agree with. Specific points in particular, and I went to the MP boss that I had, and I said, look, this here says that if I see someone doing something wrong, I'm not supposed to mention it. It's like, how does that relate to, morally what I'm supposed to be doing? It's for this and that. And so anyway, I reworded it and crossed out and reworded it so that it was appropriate for what I thought it should have been. You know, it's like, if I see something going on, I'm going to tell someone. That's simple as that. You know, I can tell the appropriate body at least. I changed quite a few things in the document, crossed them out and initialed them and did all that I thought was appropriate. And I sent it back to the department that it had to go to, and they were horrified. And I had to sit down with them and talk to them. And I said, well, look, this is not acceptable to me. This is my part of the agreement. You've put your fourth yours. You've got, 40 pages here or whatever it was at the time. There are only a few alterations that morally I can't accept. And you either accept it or you don't. And eventually they accepted it. So you can get these things done. But these days where it's all online and there's no interaction, it's incredibly difficult, if possible at all. And that's one of the ways the online system is really causing some issues. It's becoming definitely a control mechanism, where you have to agree to stuff or it just doesn't happen. And we're going to see this with the digital age restrictions as well. We're going to see if you don't accept it, if you don't provide some sort of digital ID, you may well be restricted. It's not mandated that you have to have it. It's all voluntary, but you may have to go in to deal with some government department. You may have to go in to find their department that you can go and talk to. It might be in Adelaide. It might be in Melbourne. It might be just a capital city thing. It might be a local city. Who knows? But you might have to take the time out to go down there. You may end up spending days trying to sort something out if you want to do it the proper way that's not online, or make appointments and sort things out that way. So the potential is there to really force people, like the injection mandates for COVID. We didn't force you to have it. You could take it or not, but if you didn't take it, you lost your job. But that's not forcing you. That's just a fact of life. So the fact of life is that everything's got to be filled out online. It's crazy. It really is. What was the other thing? That's probably it, apart from the fact that money's not mentioned and in the human rights declarations. And I think that's to the benefit. People don't want you questioning the use of money and the way it's not being used correctly. As Douglas said, like you mentioned in the beginning with the payments to end poverty, and we touched on it last week. We could do it during COVID and everything was acceptable and it worked and no one went hungry. It was still produced even though everything was shut down, but we can't do it after. So we can do it for an emergency. We can do it for war, like we said last week, if you want to go back and look at the TCR from last week. But during peace, we can't manufacture stuff that we're just going to blow up. Crazy, isn't it?
Or grow too many avocados and throw them back in the dirt, as farmers have previously done in this country.
Yes.
People would have been happy to consume them had they had the wherewithal to do so. That is to say, if they had money in their pocket to buy the avocados. So I wanted to come back to your point about using paper. I only had one article here to show you, but there is multiple articles about the United States moving back to a concept or a method called the Blue Book, whereby the students that are being examined are required to have their examinations done in person, in paper with a pen, because they have a rampant issue of students utilizing the newfangled ChatGPT and other like devices to give them the answers to the questions and not actively think about the things that they are learning and they're being educated with. to think for themselves. Curiously, in modern times, there was a recent TV show. It was called Phantom 2040. There was a scene between the main character and his sidekick, and this exact discussion took place, even though it was in the early 90s, the zeitgeist at that time was aware of the potential danger of relying too much on the computer for your mental thinking, as it just simply makes you dumb. Basically, the sidekick said, why would you pay to go to university when you can have the computer think for you? It's very short-sighted. You need to be able to think for yourself, analyze, and make questions of the systems that you're being exposed to, because many things may appear in one fashion, but in reality, they are doing a completely different thing. Money's, this being the nature of our channel, is much like that. The nature of money. We may think it's one thing, but it behaves and moves in different, completely different ways. It's very unexpected. Neville.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that concept. I have seen, on your prompt, I went and had a look at Phantom 2040. It's a it's definitely not the Phantom that I grew up with in the comic books. It's in the modern day era. But yes, the concepts and the actual issues that it deals with are actually very interesting. They are coming to fruition now with the surveillance systems and the corruption that we're seeing. It's tongue in cheek, well worth a bit of a look. But at your point, you know, if you go back to, I'm trying to think, was it Aristotle, Plato? One of them said, you know, well, if we teach everybody to write, we'll lose our memory. We won't be able to use our brain anymore. We're seeing a modern day version of that with, you know, well, we can find it online. We don't have to know it. We just have to know how to find it. And I guess it's the same with a library. When we had libraries of books that people went in and borrowed, you know, which we still have, by the way, if anyone wants to go and do that, please do. It's a really good way to get the brain matter working. You know where to find it, so you don't have to know anything about it. But of course, that leads to the lack of critical thinking. If you don't have the time to participate in using your brain to actually think about these things and work through a process, if you're just relying upon read page 1, 2, 3, 4 and going through the steps as you do something, like a car repair manual, then, you know, you don't actually really learn why you're doing that process. Now, to just use the example of a car manual, you know, you've got to take out certain parts of the car before you get to this other part. It doesn't necessarily tell you why in the manual, but you know that that's the sequence. If you're actually doing it, you'll realize why you have to do it, because sometimes certain items or certain parts are still live or still under pressure, so you've got to be careful. So a bit of critical thinking goes a long way. If you know you've got an electrical system in the car, and if you don't disconnect the battery anytime you touch a wire that shouldn't be touched, or it hits the bodywork, you can ground it out and create a spark. And if you've got also petrol going everywhere and a spark, it's going to get rather warm and uncomfortable. So, you know, critical thinking would say, first thing you're going to do is disconnect your battery. The other part of critical thinking there would be to say, well, this modern car has to have a power supply to its internal computer. Otherwise, you might end up with troubles. So a lot of mechanics now put a separate power supply on, which is separate to the battery. But that's another thing. It's probably outside the scope of most people to realize, but this whole point of learning and learning how to learn is crucial. And like you said, coming back to the blue book, they're going to have students writing instead of using electronic devices to do their exams. It's a damn good idea. That's what it should be. That's, you're testing how much knowledge the person has and whether they can actually put it down coherently on paper. Surely that's the purpose of learning. I know from my own experience that teachers have said at times with my kids that they like everything typed up, because if they didn't have it typed up, they would be spending so much time trying to decipher the children's writing because it's just too difficult. So they've gone for the we want it typed side of things. Now, of course, that doesn't address the actual crucial problem, is why can't the kids write legibly? Surely that's a big issue. That's something that should be addressed. The solution is not then to say, oh, we'll type it. The solution is to go back and find out why they're not writing properly, because that's critical. They can't all become doctors, you know. Then you've got the other side of it again, where they say, well, you know, there's only a certain amount of homework you're allowed to do at home now. They're restricting that, the number of hours or the amount of material you can do, because, well, we don't know if you're using ChatGPT. We can't oversee it. We can't scrutinize what you're doing. Well, mum could be doing it for you. You know, that was to be the old way, but now, of course, not mum. It could be ChatGPT. So we really are screwing up the system and we're really making it difficult. And until we get back to, you know, realizing that critical thinking and teaching kids to think correctly and to be able to know how to learn rather than just find the answers online, we're going to have that same position. But then I think a lot of that is, that's the reason why it's being done. So people won't think critically. So they accept what's being put to them. It makes you more subservient and it makes you less inclined to protest about things being wrong, because you don't think it through far enough to know whether something is actually wrong. So yeah, that's what we're seeing. Thanks, Daniel.
No worries. Yeah, the ChatGPT has some significant flaws. I've witnessed screenshots of people asking a specific question and the machine refers to secondary sources. It doesn't actually refer to its own original sources and refutes sometimes things that are in there. And it, moreover, I don't have any links right now, but you can certainly find them, of lawyers using ChatGPT in the court. And the system has referred to as hallucination. The system has made something up out of nothing with no real referencing of any real law or previous cases or anything in regards to the mechanism of the court. Just complete garbage. I'd be quite interested to see how this system, there we go, that's one example. I'd be quite interested to see how these systems will be running in 12, 18 months' time, because it's like an Erebus, like the snake that consumes itself. Head starts eating the tail and there'll be a feedback mechanism at some point and the data has to degrade. It won't be a good thing. But that was one of my curiosities. It's the reason I went to Murdoch University to go into their basement. I was looking for, while many individuals may accept whatever they find on the internet, I had an inkling for hard data. I wanted something a little bit more than that, and it existed. But I had to get out of the house and get off the computer and go into a basement to go and find it. The information's there. I'm curious to see what other pockets of Douglas social credit ephemera exist around the planet, because that one was just sitting in the basement at Murdoch University collecting mold, apparently. But that also brings back a question of archival. We talk about having digital systems, and that's also been discussed before with other technologists. 50 years from now, will we be able to read the DVDs and CDs and Blu-rays? And so, I mean, even we have issues reading VHS as of today. How are we going to read a VHS tape in 20 or 30 years from now? So humanity through the internet will lose a large portion of its memory. Particularly cultural memory, I believe, because I'm 39 years old. My generation would have remembered things like GeoCities. You talk to an 18-year-old and they would have no idea what a GeoCities is or even a Palm Pilot. I was looking at an LG TV and the outgrowth of the software that is on that TV is referred to as WebOS. WebOS came from it has the Firefox web browser, but the core base technology is the extension of the Palm Pilot software. I told him this historical story, and he looked at me and his eyes just glazed over. He's gone, really? Oh, it's just a TV. Without really realizing the significance of how it was built up and where it got to that point. I'll come to your point about the library. I've recently signed up myself. I highly recommend going to the library. My motivation was, some libraries have a subscription feature with the news, and it's called Press Reader. Press Reader effectively has all the newspapers in one spot. Again, it depends on the subscription of your library, but instead of paying, I looked at, for example, Financial Review. That's over $700 a year. It's discounted when you sign up for $7 a week, but when it comes to full price, it's a little over $700 a year just for one newspaper. And I thought, that's a bit too expensive for my taste. So you can get your news from the library. It's a good place to go. Also, speaking of news, I would like to bring up the Australian Treasure Trove section for myself. If you could bring up this week's article from the Trove catalogue. This is from the Professor of Economics at the University of Sydney, Professor R.F. Irvine. Professor R.F. Irvine, through the articles that I've read, historical art and newspaper articles I've read, he was quite the supporter of Douglas Social Credit. He believed in the deficiencies of the financial system that actually exist, primarily the fact that there's not enough purchasing power in the system to buy back all that we produce. But in addition, this particular article highlights the second point of the 11th demand, which we'll put in the link box below. The second point of the elector's demand is that new production is to be financed from new credits, not from savings. Because savings, as I understand it in reality, is unused purchasing power from the previous production cycle. So when you save, paradoxically, you're increasing not just the gap between incomes and prices, but by saving, you are leaving goods and services on the market that need to be liquidated. For every dollar that you save is a dollar on the market that has failed to be liquidated, and you've brought your community potentially one step closer to being more bankrupt simply because you didn't spend your money. We save our money under present conditions because we are uncertain of the future. But curiously, I'm of the view that it's not, the money system shouldn't be unstable as it is, because the delivery of the goods and services can take place. That is to say, the system actually exists and it's there and it can deliver the goods. The only thing preventing you from consuming it is the distribution system. That is to say, it is the money that is preventing you from consuming the greatness that we as humanity can produce with its productive system. Economic democracy is directly mentioned in this article by Clifford Hugh Douglas. It's his first book. Major Clifford Hugh Douglas' first book was Economic Democracy. It's certainly a good effort to read. Yeah, I've also made the effort to orate this book on my own channel, the Douglas Social Credit Study Group on Rumble. So if you are not interested in reading all of it, you could probably sit down and be listening to my voice to this book if you prefer. So again, while we have stringent conditions as we experience today, we don't ever have enough money in our pocket. It's always a good idea to spend your money. It means that the market can move forward and potentially someone else can then do something else and so on. Money is not something to be saved or can be considered a commodity. Money is something to be considered effectively as an exchange ticket. Or a demand system is another way to describe it. So spend your money. Have a good time. And don't give your money to donations. Give it to the kid down the street. He'd probably enjoy it more. Neville.
Yeah, look. Yeah, I don't know that I'd go so far as to don't save it, but I understand the concept behind that. You've got to save a certain amount to be able to, of course, afford larger items. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Of course not.
But the fact that we're restricted from purchasing everything that's being produced is just, it's a nonsense. It really is. And you look, when they've had, you know, Feed the World and all these other big pushes, or, you know, the different groups, Amnesty or all these do-good groups that say, oh, we should be feeding the poor, starving people wherever they are. The world does produce more than we can ever consume. It's just the distribution, like you say. And when it comes down to it, it's not the fact that we can't physically distribute it, because we can still pay, you know, we can pay the ships and the sailors and the wharfies to load the excess food and take it to Somalia if they're starving. It's just the fact that we can't pay them. We don't have the money to do so. The goods are there. The need is there. All of the requirements to do this job are possible, but for some reason they can't tap a few keys on the computer and put it into existence to actually achieve it. It's That is the whole issue. That is what Douglas approached. The fact that there's an inequality within the system doesn't work the way it should. And his suggestions as to how to go about fixing those are well worth the time to read and try to understand, because we will continue to have this problem while we continue to work under the Keynesian or free market economies that, you know, they keep flogging off to us. I don't know how you get around that, because it's very hard for people to come to grips with the real purpose of money. They seem to think, for some reason, that it's a commodity, and everybody's got it in their mind that, you know, if you save it, if you invest it, you know, it's going to breed more money. Well, it might breed some more money in terms of you get interest for it, but by the time you take account inflation and everything else into account, you can save as long as you want, as hard as you want, for that house. But if everything keeps going up the way it's been going up, you'll never have a deposit. It's just, you'll never meet that target because of the way the system is working. And that's how they keep us nose to the grindstone. So yeah, it's interesting. Thanks, Daniel.
So as solutions, the social credit or Clifford Hugh Douglas's ideas in regards to a solution, there were two primary mechanisms that he thought about. The one we've already discussed is the national dividend. It's a sum of money that goes into your pocket to purchase your share of national productivity. The second mechanism, and it's a voluntary one, but it's one that is probably necessary to put a backstop on prices, is called the national discount, whereby the retailer sells below costs but is then reimbursed by the National Credit Authority from the... Now, it's the balance sheet. What's the other word for the balance sheet in regards to this one? My apologies. Because you have two sets of books. You've got the national balance sheet and the national supply and demand document. And that, through the National Credit Authority and the national balance sheet, retailer can then be reimbursed for selling goods below costs. Or the other mechanism that Douglas, another type of discount. You pay full price at the retailer, and then you get reimbursed by your bank, and the bank is then reimbursed by the National Credit Authority. But again, this is where we have an information asymmetry problem. Our viewers are probably likely aware of these solutions. It is those who are not aware of these solutions that are our focus. So if, again, I've been mentioning it before, but I'll always say it while I'm here. If you're watching today, please tell your neighbor about Douglas Social Credit. I've been trying to do my efforts. Many people do appreciate the fact that Australia has ended inflation in this country for a couple of years. I've been able to, when you show them the data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, they do respond quite well. Then the next question is, why aren't we doing that now? So we need to put some pressure on our politicians. Again, the electors' demand will be linked in the description below. Fill it in. Tell your neighbour. Tell anyone who is willing to listen. Thank you very much. This is the one sphere of agreement, I believe, that will bring some form of unity to the community, because we are all struggling for money. It's our constant and one single issue. It's never the productive side of the system. I could understand if the wheat fields were burnt, the soil does not produce. I could understand if you smashed the factories and the machinery and you couldn't produce anything, but they are, in fact, there. That's the thing that annoys me the most. They are, in fact, there for all of our benefit, not just a certain group, but for all our benefit. And there is enough to go around. There is enough for us to consume. What we don't have enough of is money in our pockets to consume them. We don't have enough purchasing power. So this is I understand that this argument has been going on for many years. Just print more money. But we have to print the right amount of money in relation to the right amount of goods. We have the goods. Let's print the money for us to consume it. Neville, your thoughts, please.
It's basically the national balance sheet. You've got to look at what's being made in the country and how, yeah, whether we can consume it. If it's being made and it's in surplus, then why are we making it? Yeah. So like we always used to ask, I used to ask at one stage, why doesn't the government have a balance sheet? We never see an actual balance sheet. They do their, you know, they do their treasury things, but it never comes down to tin tacks like you have to do with a normal business. In going, outgoing, goods produced. That's what Douglas was saying when he's talking about a national credit authority, somebody who can look at the overall picture and say just exactly how much Australia as a, I don't want to use the word company because I don't think that's correct, as a body, as a national body, produces. And if we produce in excess of what we need, then it's an excess. But if we're producing in excess and people are still starving or trying very hard to survive, then there's definitely something wrong. Their money should be in the system to enable everybody to have their share of that increment of association, that inherited wealth that we've got. We've now have machines doing the work for us. So, you know, we don't need as many people in the workforce getting a wage to obtain the profit from our productivity, but we need to be able to access it. The only way we can access it is by making a national dividend or a retailer discount, which are the two different methods that he mentions. Moving on from that, I thought it was interesting that Victoria here, you probably don't know this, or maybe you do know a little bit, the government here, our lovely government, has decided that we've got a treaty now, an Aboriginal treaty with the First Nations people of this Victoria, which will entitle them to, I believe, two votes, one in their own Indigenous assembly, and still have one within their within the state assembly as well. So that's an interesting concept. There's already some kerfuffle over it because one of the members of, I'm trying to find it, it's called, so that's St. Vincent's Hospital's the other one. We're just seeing different things happening. And here, St. Vinny's have been told to boost the emergency triage category for Aboriginal patients up so that they get seen before other people. Now, I understand if there's an issue that Aboriginal people aren't being seen in due course or in due time. It's a bit like this educational thing that we're talking about where, you know, the teachers could read the students' handwriting. The problem resides further back. The problem resides with the not teaching them to write correctly in the first place. With St. Vinny's, where they're trying to make it equitable or whatever they want to call it, whatever the spin they want to put on it, they're bumping them up in the system of the triage. Or maybe they're not doing the triage properly. I know one of the comments was, they come in and they often don't say that they're as bad as they are. Well, you know, that's not for them to assess. That's for the triage nurse to assess. That's for the triage doctors to deal with, you know. You get a farmer going in and says, oh, it's not much really. And he's got the finger in his one hand and, you know, a rag wrapped around the other hand where the finger's missing. Oh, it's not that bad. Well, that's his opinion. You know, the triage nurse should be able to look at all the other patients and say, well, you know, the other 10 here have only got sniffles. We need to treat you now. You know, it's like that's the whole point of triage. I don't understand the problem there. You know, if someone comes in and they said, oh, it's just a little bit of a head wound, well, you flick the pen in the eyes and you see if both pupils are dilating. If one's not, bang, up the triage, get them in quicker. You know, if they're bleeding out on the floor, well, bang, up the triage. You know, that's how an emergency department works. To then go and suggest that, oh, we're going to have some sort of bureaucratic regulation to say that, okay, we've ticked the box for Aboriginal here, or First Nations. I don't know which term to use because it's so confusing. Everyone gets crook about one or the other. So we'll just use them interchangeably. Don't take any offence. And because they've ticked that box, they're suddenly 30 minutes ahead of everybody else. I don't understand that. Do this properly, do triage properly, and there shouldn't be an issue. You know, it's doesn't matter what colour you are, what shape you are, everything depends upon your medical condition when you come in. Now, they're hoping that treaty is going to fix this. You know, they're hoping that treaty is going to fix all these inequalities. But as I understand it, what's happened here, the people who voted for this called assembly was 3% of the Aboriginal population, this state. So 3% of the people who are eligible voted. Is that democracy? You've then got a group, Auntie Pauline and another lady from an area up in northern Victoria, who are saying that the actual words that they're using, Jalung Wall, I pronounced that correctly, should not be being used because it was never allowed. Like it's their language. It means tip of the spear or something else. And they didn't agree that. They said, no, we don't want our language being used for this purpose. It's we're not out of it. We don't want it. And they've asked for it to be removed from the treaty legislation wording. And we'll see where that kerfuffle ends up. But here they have, they're saying, you know, they've been working on it for years. They've been doing this, they've been doing that. But when they come and actually put it up, there's a huge amount of discord among the people that it's supposed to be representing. And follow that. You know, it's something you should be looking at. I'm trying to remember the name of the MP that was mentioning it because I saw him talking about it the other day. But Kurnai Elder Auntie Cheryl Drayton has called for the treaty bill to be abandoned. This is in the Daily Mail news article. Can't see how it's going to work. It doesn't tell how people are going to get elected. So again, you know, they've spent a lot of money at it, and they could have been spent developing communities, she says. So, treaty will never solve anything. All it does is create South Africa and Australia, basically. The very thing that all these black people were crying about South Africa being an apartheid state. Well, we now have it in Victoria. So congratulations, Jacinta. You've done a good job at creating apartheid in Australia. Any comments, Daniel?
Well, coming to the triage, irrespective, as you said, Neville, quite correctly, as far as I'm concerned, irrespective of who you are, where you come from, the colour of your skin, your medical condition in that moment would be the defining factor as to receiving the correct type of medical care. It's quite horrible to think you would receive some type of different medical care based on the color of your skin. If you have an emergency, you have an emergency. So it must be resolved. And a medical issue does not see a color per se. You have an issue and it needs to be resolved. Shouldn't know. But not only that, the behavior of the Victorian government, from my understanding of the situation, the Australian nation as a peoples, as a whole, with a referendum for the voice vote, said no. The large overwhelming result from the referendum was the Australian nation said no and the citizens said no. For the government then to turn around and say, no, we're going to do it anyway, and I'll be quoting a phrase here, but I do believe in the statement, is of the racist mentality. You've said no, and the government's going to do it to you anyway. That's reprehensible. We need to be certainly pulling them back into line and making sure that we get the results that we want from our government, because it's going to create more issues than it solves. And that's the larger concern. Irrespective of the document, it's going to, as you've correctly mentioned, Neville, it's going to create a whole bunch more problems than it's going to ever solve. From my understanding of Australia's history, we're meant to be subject to basically common law. There is no one particular group that is above or below the other. We are all individuals is the word judged or subjected to the same type of law, irrespective of faith, religion, color, gender, and so on. We are to be subjected to an equal treatment. Otherwise, it does create divisions within society. We have friction. Unnecessary friction, and we could simply just be getting along. Was there any other thoughts you had today, Neville? You go.
Just with that. We're all supposed to be equal under the law. There shouldn't be some that are more equal than others. If there's an issue where people are not getting by or they're having difficulties, then we should be able to address that, and we should be capable of it. If you look at the amount of money they've thrown in that direction into the Aboriginal industry, and I'll call it an industry because there are many people who are making huge profits out of it, but it's not going back to the people that need it. Jacinta Price has mentioned that so many times about all the money that's being put into fixing the problem, and yet it gets siphoned off and put somewhere because it's never held accountable. The amount they spent on The Voice, for heaven's sake, you know. And now with this in Victoria, it won't solve any problems. We'll still have the same problems because, again, only 3% of the Aboriginal people voted for it. I believe that's correct. I would have to look that to guarantee it. But, you know, get out and start doing some research and find out just how many people this actually does affect and how many people have had a part in it. If it's just the activists, then you know what you're going to get. You get more activism and less actual help on the ground in the communities that need it, the rural communities, the Aboriginal communities. They need the help. They need, you know, the money being spent properly within their spheres. A voice is not going to change that. We're still going to have exact same issues because the people who are voting and people who are participating in it are essentially part of the problem at the moment. You know, most of them have been involved in it and they're still involved in it, and nothing was ever fixed while they were involved in the first place. But they think this magical treaty, where we're going to be treating people differently, is better. I mean, heck, back in the 60s, when we actually recognized the Aboriginal people within the Constitution as being part of the Australian people, that was a big thing, and everybody jumped up and clapped and everything. And now we're going around and we're doing the opposite again. We're recognising them as a sick people. So we're winding ourselves back to the 1960s again, or worse, you know, South African apartheid. Yes, it's crazy. I can't understand anyone would think that this is going to bring a nation together. Thanks.
I suppose that would be a lovely way to wrap up. We've had covered quite a few subjects today. I think they've been good discussions. Thank you for your time, Neville. Thank you for your time, audience. And we look forward to hearing from you soon with the questions. Thank you.
This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.